Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. It's a new year, and if your resolution is to read or write more, we have some ideas for you. This week, I'll be talking with former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky, whose new book is Singing School, Learning to Write and Read Poetry by Studying with the Masters. We'll also hear from book critic John Freeman, whose new book is How to Read a Novelist. And I'll have some thoughts on new books about books and reading and writers. My first guest is the great Robert Pinsky, former United States Poet Laureate, author of 8 collections of poetry, most recently his selected poems, and many other works of criticism and translation. His newest book is Singing School, Learning to Write and Read Poetry by Studying with the Masters. Welcome to The Reading Life, Robert.
Pleasure to be talking to you, Susan.
Now, the title of Singing School comes from that famous poem, Sailing to Byzantium, by William Butler Yeats. And that is such a lovely conceit, that idea of musical training as the perfect training for reading and writing poetry.
It's how you learn music, is listening to music. How you learn a sport is by playing the sport and watching it. And I'm happy to say that I checked the original draft of Yeats's poem. He just says it even more definitely. There is no singing school, but studying monuments of its own magnificence. So taking that title, Singing School, was a way of saying, if we're cooks, let's get into the actual kitchen.
And memory is so important in this book as well. I loved it when you described hearing Allen Ginsberg recite Lycidas. That role of memory in poetry means so much, doesn't it?
And the best time is when you find that you have memorized something without intending to. You know, you love it so much and you've read it enough times and you realize, gee, I guess I have it by heart.
I know. I love that expression, having something by heart, don't you?
Yes. I encourage teachers, you know, I do this institute for K-12 teachers every July, and we encourage them not to assign everybody some one poem to get by heart, but to encourage each person in the class to choose something that you think is worth getting by heart and saying to the rest of us.
Oh, wow. I wonder what poem I would choose.
See right away.
I know.
Among other things, it makes each person look around in their mental and actual library so that the process of choosing, even before you've chosen, is helpful and instructive.
So you have 80 poems in this book. Do you know all of these poems by heart?
No. Some of them I know partly by heart. Quite a few of them I probably do know by heart. And after all, some of them are pretty long.
Yes, very long.
I'm amazed that I put in, you know, page after page of Andrew Marvell's Upon Appleton House. As I say in the introduction to that poem, well, you might want to start at the last 4 or 5 stanzas when the guys put their canoes on their heads.
I know. I thought that was very generous of you. Just take a little time.
I'd be happy to get by heart anything in this book. This book is entirely made out of things that I either have by heart or would be willing to get by heart.
Mm-hmm.
As I say in the foreword to the whole book, the book really is meant to encourage each person in this age of the digital information. Each reader, if the book works, will replace the book with a personal anthology that each person makes, so that I can do only 80 poems because I want the reader to do another 180 over the next years.
Now, you've divided Singing School into 4 sections, freedom, listening, form, and dreaming things up. And the rhythms of this kind of progression, aren't these the way any artist would approach learning an art, music or poetry or visual arts or dancing, that undertaking of the very best and that constant engagement with it before you move on to your own work?
That's right. It's in the spirit of sports, of music, of dance. And I tried hard to make a book that approached poetry as an art. I think a lot of well-meaning teachers have given people a very school feeling about poetry. And making the first section freedom was important to me.
I can see and, why.
It's like basically getting the kids out on the field and let them just kick the soccer ball around aimlessly for a while. Or just take a mouth organ or a piano and just play, do whatever you want. And then doing that will give you an appetite for chapter two, is listening. Mm-hmm. Sports, it would be playing or paying attention. So you begin with freedom and you end with dreaming things up. So that I hope, without being sentimental or soft, I put the emphasis on imagination mm-hmm. and hearing.
Now, you've always been concerned with sound, with pure sound in poetry. And I'll never forget hearing you read that title poem from Gulf Music, which for our New Orleans readers is so special because it features the rhythms of Professor Longhair.
Yeah, I really like hearing someone from New Orleans say that because I wanted very much not to write the kind of touristic poem. I was there for 4 days and picked up some local lore and I threw it in. I did want to go beyond that. As I guess you know, I grew up in a seashore resort town in New Jersey, and we had our Sandy.
Yes, I know.
And I grew up, when I was 4 years old, the boardwalk in Long Branch, New Jersey, got destroyed by a hurricane. It was kind of a myth for me as a kid. So I tried to put Professor Longhair in that poem. Those sounds, I mean, the first line of the poem is Mala Walla Tella Bella, Trama Tra La 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 La, Mala Bell. And I hope a tribute to Longhair and Tipitina. And I'll quibble with you, Susan. Yes, it is pure sound, but away no sound is pure. When you say Mala Bell, you're saying something.
Right.
And when you say Wanna Dollar, you may be saying something. And you can't have pure meaning and you can't have pure nonsense once you're talking about sounds.
Right.
Some sound happy, some sound sad. And no matter how precise meanings are, words are also grunts.
That's true, too.
The art of the writer is to put the grunts together in a way that besides meaning something or having some feeling, it's a nice pattern of grunts.
Yes, it is. Now, you could have written a book like Singing School, and one of the things I love about it is that you have these introductions to every poem with prompts for writing and things to consider in your reading of the poems. You could have written this book, truthfully, using only your own work. And yet, you've always been, as long as I've known you, very generous in sharing the work of others. You love to lead readers from one poet to the next. And that, I've found, is often the hallmark of very fine poets, that kind of generosity.
Musicians I love are that way about music. They're always paying tribute uh-huh. to other music and digging other musicians. And I guess my ideal is to be like a musician, jazz musicians in particular. As people have said, you have to listen to one another to do it. And it's an inherently communal, some people have said inherently democratic process. And that's my model for art. So I'm as serious about my own poems as I am about anything, but I want to present them as made by somebody who's part of the nation of poetry. Honor the past and respect the ones to come. You know, be a conduit between them. I don't think that diminishes one's own work. I think it enhances it. That's one of the things any poem does, is it does look back to the ancestors, and I hope it looks forward mm-hmm. to what's new.
Now, you have traveled so much. You've traveled America in your work as Poet Laureate, and you've appeared on an episode of The Simpsons as yourself, and you've umpired that Metaphor for All with Stephen Colbert and Sean Penn. That was a very brave move. And in all this, in addition to not taking yourself all that seriously all the time, you do seem to have uncovered this hunger for poetry.
I see it so much. Favorite Poem Project, those videos at favoritepoem.org. Sometimes it's covert. People feel their love for something they memorized in high school or before isn't hip enough or highbrow enough. And I think the appetite for poetry, in my opinion, is similar to the appetite for music or for dancing, which is close to universal. There will be people who say they don't like music or they don't like to dance, and I think it's usually some terrible inhibition that's muffled the appetite. But these are natural things. You know, putting language together in a way that sounds good. I have an infant grandson, and I've discovered that singing to him or reciting to him produces exactly the same kind of attentive little pleasure. And that confirms my sense that this is basic in us. It's fundamental. Pardon me, but in a way, you have to go to school to learn not to like poetry.
So true.
All little kids like it. It takes education not to like it.
Oh, sad but true. Well, we've been talking with former poet laureate Robert Pinsky, whose most recent book is Singing School, Learning to Write and Read Poetry by Studying with the Masters. Thank you so much.
It's truly a pleasure, Susan, and regards to all my friends there.
John Freeman is a longtime literary journalist whose interviews and reviews have appeared in more than 200 publications. He's also the former editor of Granta and the former president of the National Book Critics Circle. His first book, The Tyranny of Email, was published in 2009, and now he's back with a collection of 55 interviews called How to Read a Novelist. John Freeman, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, thanks for having me.
There's so much wonderful conversation in How to Read a Novelist. What was it like for you to go back and review your own body of work that way, to pick and choose?
It was a bit like a dog circling back to its own vomit.
Oh, no!
You know, because when you read something that you've written 10, 8, 7, even 2 years ago, you see the difference between who you were then and who you are at the very present moment. And as a literary journalist, even if your job is to try to get out of the picture, to be the sort of orienting light or consciousness or gaze through which readers encounter a writer on the page in an interview, you still have your personality there and the words you choose and the words you're obsessed with. And so I had to go back and re-edit, which I think was good for all the interviews and probably will change the way I write them in the future.
Ah, well, I loved your introduction and I loved the way you described your obsession with John Updike.
Yeah, gosh, that was... It would be funnier if it wasn't such a true story. I was obsessed with Kerouac before Updike, and then when I moved to New York in the mid-90s, Updike was kind of my adult equivalent. And in fact, Updike wrote Rabbit Run as a response to On the Road. It was him saying, look, not all of us can hit the road and have kicks and see the open landscape. You know, some of us have marriages, and in that book, the escape hatch is an affair, which it is so often in Updike. And when I was given those books, I didn't so much relate to that, but rather to the language and to the sense of Pennsylvania as this kind of circumambient embrace. And I became quite obsessed. I read all these books, a lot, almost all of his books, especially the criticism. Moved to New England thinking, okay, I'm going to become like Updike and write books. But instead, I just kept reading Updike because there was so much of him to read. And bought the first editions, got them signed, went to his readings. And eventually, I was going to get married, and I had all of his books signed. And it was the most valuable thing I had, but it also felt sort of symbolically not that good a thing to have sitting in your household when you're starting a marriage. So I took them all to a New York dealer, sold them, and bought my wife's ring, and a real conflict diamond, if you will. And I was surprised, you know, a year later when it all fell apart. I mean, she moved out, and I was living alone, and all those sort of invented obstacles I had made for myself, thinking that they were in the way of me writing, were gone, and there I was just sitting there chain-smoking and feeling sorry for myself. Along the same time, I had become an interviewer, as you mentioned, and I'd interviewed Updike once or twice before, once for his book Seek My Face, which is a novel entirely set during an interview. And I loved talking to him because he was such a proficient lyrical speaker. He spoke the way he wrote in complete sentences and paragraphs with flourishes of language. And eventually, I had to get divorced, and this was 3 years after I got married, and I went to New England where I got married and went to divorce court, and weirdly, on the same day that I was getting divorced, I had an interview scheduled with John Updike.
Jeez.
Yeah. So I left divorce court at, you know, 7:30 in the morning. They opened really early in Maine, and I drove straight down to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, where I met Updike in person for the first time as an interviewer. I'd always done my interviews over the telephone with him. And the conceit was that we were going to walk around the museum and look at paintings he had written about in this book called Still Looking, and then he would kind of riff in real time. I arrived a little bit late, kind of beard, stubby face, and ripped jeans. But anyway, he jumped right in, and he was amazing at it. He was giving me all these great anecdotes about meeting Andy Warhol at galleries in the 1960s. And, you know, he would come to these paintings, and You know, he would come up with these amazing prose poems of appreciation. And eventually, after about an hour of this, he sort of felt like maybe this was done and the photographer had not shown up. So we sort of paused and he said, "So I understand you're coming from Vermont." He's making small talk. And I said, "No, I'm coming from Maine." And he said, "What were you doing in Maine?" And I said, "Well, I was getting divorced." Yeah. And the interview came to a screeching halt. And eventually, very quickly, actually, he started to give me advice. I was trying to make light of it, trying to get out of this collision of my personal life with our interview. And he was not having that. He said, "Do you have kids? Do you have property?" And eventually I just sort of whited out because it was just a real experience. And came back to and we finished the interview. And around that time, I had started the very degrading process of buying back my own first editions from the dealer I had sold them to.
Oh, that is painful, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was, I was broke. I had gotten divorced, and so I basically could only afford the books that were unsigned and the poetry, which was good for me, too, because I was having trouble focusing on anything longer than a page. And I realized as he was signing it that the book I had brought with me to sign was the book of poems he published the year he got divorced called Tossing and Turning. And I thought, oh, geez, he's going to think I'm a freak, and, Anyway, I drove back to New York, wrote up the interview. 9 months go by, and there was another novel, and an editor asked me if I could speak to him about this novel, Terrorist. And I said, "Oh, yeah, Updike and I are old chaps, talked about our divorces together. This will be fine." And finally got the publicist on the telephone, and he said, "Yeah, we got some mixed feedback from John about the last interview." And I knew immediately what he was talking about.
That, oh, dear.
Yeah,
oh, dear.
And I felt really, really embarrassed. And he said, "You got to understand, John's kind of an old school guy, and maybe you had ripped jeans, and there's something going on in your personal life." And I said, "Yeah, I was getting divorced." And he said, "Well, listen, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to make him uncomfortable." And I basically said, "I'll do this interview. I'll do it very professionally." So they scheduled this thing, which I got there, and it was like plane circling O'Hara. It was a junket. There was seven of us there waiting to talk to Updike. And I wanted to go and do this as a SWAT team, like just drop in, get the interview, and leave. There'd just be nothing of me. So I thought the only thing I could really do that would be to wear a black suit, kind of erase myself. I got in there, and he looked at me and said, "Ah, John Freeman. And I did the interview. It was really nice. And after that, I never interviewed a writer in the same way, which is that in normal conversation, we sort of trade anecdotes, and we offer various pieces of personal information, and sometimes that escalates to, what we think we're doing is bonding, or in fact, we're just making sure that we're equally revealed. And in an interview, that doesn't work. It doesn't happen at all that way. What you're trying to do is keep the person talking and revealing and telling stories and telling personal anecdotes as the interviewer. This simply gets in the way. It clouds the whole process. Eventually, I found I never did that again.
Ah. So how has doing all these interviews changed your own writing?
Well, it's made me less fearful. If not less fearful, then certainly less anxious about being fearful, because the one thing that keeps coming up in all these interviews, and I talk to a lot of people with big egos, John Irving, Norman Mailer, Toni Morrison, that failure is a constant thing that comes up in these interviews. People talk about the fear of not getting it done, the sort of dead ends they run into. And as a writer, that's hugely encouraging, because you go to a bookstore and you see the good books or the books that are chosen by the staff and whatever. You see books in your classroom as a student. They feel inevitable. They feel like they've always been there. And yet, speaking to all these novelists, you realize that they get through a process of 95% failure, crossing things out, of throwing them away, of trying to make sense of an experience for a long time and suddenly getting it 20 or 30 or 40 years later. So for me, it's made me much more comfortable with the ongoing daily effort, in the sense that, I'm almost 40 now, so I'm not so much in a hurry to get it down and get it done, because I feel like you look at people like Lessing, who wrote into her 90s, or Gordimer, who's in the book, who is still writing today, and you see that hopefully life is long, and that if you're lucky, you can find ways to make use of all of it in your writing.
It is kind of a privilege to bear witness to that constancy,
Yeah, I felt lucky to talk to these people. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Sacramento, and I went to public high schools. My parents were not intellectuals, but they were readers, and they pushed books at me. But still, I was never thinking I would have a life where I would collide with people like Gunter Grass or Toni Morrison, David Foster Wallace, the people I've interviewed. And I feel very privileged to have gotten a chance to speak to them, even if it's just for an hour. So I'm happy that it's in a book, because you know this as a book critic, you have the lifespan of a mosquito. It's like,
so true.
On, in newsprint, it's dying, and then it's dead by the next day. And, you know, yes, with the internet, things live longer, but to find them on the internet, you often have to know that you want to look for them. And that's the sad thing about the death of newspapers to some degree. Not the death, but, you know, the hospice care of newspapers, if you will. You know, the people don't find stuff by accident nearly as much as you did when you had a newspaper open in front of your table with your breakfast.
Every day.
Yeah. And I want, you know, the whole point of a critic for me is to not just publicly learn, which is, I think, one big part of it, but to share in the enthusiasm for something that feels rare. And to sit down with someone like Lessing, to me, feels rare. And for it to not live after newsprint is done and the next day's paper has come out felt a little bit frustrating. And now, thanks to this, they're around. And I hope people find them because they gave me solace in writing them. So the only hope is that it gives other readers and writers solace in reading them.
Well, I love it when you say that meeting a novelist is electrifying for you. And you make the reader feel that in these articles. And that's a great gift. It's a gift to readers and to other writers. So thank you.
I'm just a vibrating cord. You know, I didn't start the vibration. I'm just transmitting it.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with John Freeman, whose new book is How to Read a Novelist. You can meet him at this year's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Susan.
You know you're a book lover when you have an entire shelf devoted to books about books and reading and writing. That's part of the fun, of course, knowing you're part of a community of readers. Here are some of the titles I've added to my collection recently. Slow Reading in a Hurried Age by University of Houston professor David Mikix is a tonic for anyone who worries about a shrinking attention span or keeping up with all the reading on screen or anyone who thinks they've lost the capacity to think and read deeply. Mikix puts forth his 14 rules for reading with illuminating examples drawn from literature. Simple things are always worth considering, aren't they? So it's good to be reminded to be patient, or to ask the right questions, or identify the voice, or get a sense of style. Mikix concludes with chapters devoted to various forms, novels, poetry, drama, essays. This book will inspire and guide you to a deeper reading life. I love how Mikix quotes Virginia Woolf's beautiful justification for reading. Here it is. Are there not some pursuits that we practice because they are good in themselves, and some pleasures that are final? And is this not among them? I have sometimes dreamt at last that when the day of judgment dawns, and the great conquerors and lawyers and statesmen come to receive their rewards, their crowns, their laurels, their names carved indelibly upon impermeable marble, the Almighty will turn to Peter and will say, not without a certain envy when he sees us coming with our books under our arms, "Look, these need no reward. We have nothing to give them here. They have loved reading." There's one book I'll be keeping on my desk throughout the coming year, and that is the delightful Reader's Book of Days by Tom Nisley, which takes us through the calendar year in delightful fashion. The entry for each day lists births and deaths and provides an almanac of both real and fictional characters and achievements. In addition, there's recommended reading for every month. Recommended offerings for February include Jane Austen's Persuasion, Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness, Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd, and The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, the third volume of the autobiography of the man who chose to celebrate his birthday on Valentine's Day. This book will brighten your day and lead you to many others. If you believe the literature can cure what ails you, you'll want to take a look at The Novel Cure, or, as the subtitle puts it, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 Books to Cure What Ails You, by Ella Bertieu and Susan Elderkin, who met at Cambridge 25 years ago and, after exchanging book recommendations, hit upon the notion of becoming bibliotherapist. So this book prescribes books for various conditions. And come to think of it, Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet might very well be a fine cure for wanderlust. The authors also list the 10 best books for young readers in Teens Being in Your. There are delightful cures for reading ailments like fear of finishing the book you're reading, and distracted by household chores and compulsive book buying. One of the more delightful recommendations for jam, being N-A, is Jan Martel's The Life of Pi. Yep, that would put things right in perspective. This is a delightful source for book groups. And don't forget, what is your local bookseller but a bibliotherapist, really? Of course, reading leads to curiosity about writers and their lives, and Olivia Lang takes on that old idea of literary lubrication in The Trip to Echo Spring on Writers and Drinking. Lang visits the United States, tracing the footsteps of six well-known alcoholic writers: Tennessee Williams, John Cheever, Raymond Carver, John Berryman, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Ernest Hemingway. The title comes from a line in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. When Brick asks for his crutch and Big Daddy asks him where he's going, Brick says, "I'm taking a trip to Echo Spring," meaning the liquor cabinet that contains the bourbon of the same name. Lang's travels bring her to New Orleans for the centennial Tennessee Williams Festival. She attends a scholars conference and takes a walking tour with Nora Marsh. This is a warmly compassionate book, filled with insights into the author's works, as well as awareness of the alcoholic life, for Olivia Lang grew up in an alcoholic family herself. You'll think about these authors with her voice in mind for a while, filled as it is with admiration for the achievement of these writers and sympathy for their lives beyond the page. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. There will be a happy hour for the Oblivion Atlas, featuring Jeff Louvier, Vanessa Brown, and Michael Alenzel, Wednesday, January 29th at 6 at Mimi's in the Marigny. There'll also be readings by noted actors Michael Martin and Richard Mayer. Marty Mulay signs Game Changers, The Legacy of Louisiana Sports, Wednesday, January 29th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. John Barron signs Concert Life in 19th Century New Orleans, Thursday, January 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kid Chef Eliana signs her new cookbook, Cool Kids Cook, Fresh and Fit, Saturday, February 1st at 2:30 at Octavia Books. Chef Jackie Pfeiffer discusses and signs The Art of French Pastry, Monday, February 3rd at 11 at Maple Street Bookshop. Janet Moulton, author of The Headless Palm, is the guest author at the Fiction Writers Group Monday, January 3rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. George Fowler II signs My Cuba Libre, Bringing Fidel Castro to Justice, Tuesday, February 4th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Orange is the New Black by Piper Kerman, Tuesday, February 4th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Wendy Webb signs The Vanishing, Tuesday, February 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poet Shelley Taylor, author of Black Eyed Heifer and Dirt City Lions, is the featured reader in the 1728 reading series, Tuesday, February 4th at 7 at the Columns Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue. And Errol Laborde, author of Mardi Gras, Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival, will discuss the food associated with carnival season at 7, that's Tuesday, February 4th, at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, as part of the Culinary Legacy Series, hosted by Liz Williams of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.